Unsilencing Stories is a podcast that reflects the voices of people in small towns and communities in Canada who have lost loved ones to the toxic drug supply crisis. Since 2016, more than 30,000 people have died from fatal overdoses in Canada, and that number continues to climb. The risk in smaller towns and communities is much higher than in urban areas because of a lack of harm reduction services and stigma against substance use and people who use drugs. This podcast is part of a community-based participatory research project facilitated by Erin Goodman, PhD, a faculty member at Kwantlen Polytechnic University in Surrey, BC, along with students Jenna Keeble and Ashley Pokernich. The aim was to assist collaborators in publicly memorializing their loved ones and expressing grief, as well as challenging silences imposed by dominant media organizations and stigma from society against substance use and people who use drugs. We hope these nuanced stories make it clear why the government needs to be doing more to prevent further deaths. Please note, this podcast contains information about overdose death, grief, and trauma that may be distressing to listen to. In this episode, you'll hear Jerome Desmarchais-Vaught speaking with Marianne Ryan in Cranbrook, BC. Marianne remembers her friend Jared, who died from an opioid overdose.
Hi, my name is Marianne Ryan. I live in Kimberley, BC. I have a few friends that have recently died, and I want to acknowledge, especially the most recent one I lost was Brennan Bauer, who was a close friend of mine. I didn't know him very intimately. I didn't have very intimate talks with him, but I've known him for a long time, and I know he was a fighter. And he struggled for a very long time before he lost his life, and I wanted to acknowledge that. However, I have had a bit of a closer experience with Jared, and I think I have some good insight into his life that I would be able to share, so I'm going to talk about him. Since Jared, I believe he's 31. Did you know how old he was?
He was very young. I know he was, he couldn't have been much older than me, probably about that age.
He lived on the streets in Cranbrook. The first time I remember seeing him, I remember we were outside. I saw him at the shelter that I was living there at the time, staying at the shelter, and I saw that he was a bit temperamental and that people had a hard time getting along with him. They were giving out free pizzas at, I think it was Domino's, and they would give you these little chips, and we would go and we'd get a free individual pizza. And so we were hanging out there, and he had a Care Bears backpack on, and he was kind of picking fights. I was the only female there, so I kind of had to stand in between and be like, hey, man, let's chill out. And I remember he just looked at me with this, look of, and it wasn't an evil look. It was just an intense look. He was like, who are you? I was like, I'm MJ, I'm Marianne, it's okay. I'm not here to get in a fight with you. And I remember feeling this big with that look that he had. And needless to say, he was like, okay, yeah, Marianne, nice to meet you. But it was definitely a moment where I was like, whoa, you were way more intense than I expected you to be.
Is that your best memory of him?
Oh, no, I have some really good memories. We actually, when I had left the travel lodge, they had kicked me out for whatever reason, and I was camping in a tent right outside of Street Angels, and I was the first one to kind of set up tent there in the summer, and so several people followed, but Jared was the only one consistent one that stayed for a long amount of time. And I was kind of happy he was there because he provided me with some sort of protection. So a single female staying there on my own in the middle of the night, you just don't know who's going to try and get into your tent, right? And he had come over once that we were right beside the skate park, so the teenagers would often bug him about what he believed, right? He was very vocal about being Jesus and that the world was ending and that we were all clones. We were all clones of his mother. He used to say, you're all clones of my mother. And so we were all dead except for him. He was the only one that was alive. And so these kids would kind of bug him for it. And one time I had heard them really calling him out, and I went over and I said, you know, you guys got to quit this. Like, everybody is allowed to have their own beliefs and their own opinions. We don't have to cut them down to make it heard. You can just say what you believe and walk away. And yeah, they listened. I was pretty happy about that. And after that, he started coming to my tent. And he would ask me for cigarettes and stuff like that. And he'd sit there and was sharing some stories with me. And, you know, I felt that he had been shut down so many times that he just needed someone to believe him, to truly, and not just say it, but to feel it. I wanted to feel it inside. I wanted to feel inside that I believed him. And so when he told me he was Jesus, I'd look him straight in the eyes. I believe what you're saying. And I felt it too. Like, there's so much that happens in this world that we don't know. So, you know, who's to say that he's not who he says he is, you know?
They say it for our sins. And I think he was ready for that. Like,
yeah.
What did he mean to you?
Well, we kind of created a friendship based on him just coming over and having smokes with me. He kind of became like a bit of a big brother, I'd say. He was a protector. He would help me if somebody was after me, or was doing something to me that was unkind. He would step up and stick up for me.
Are you comfortable to talk about his death and how he died?
Yeah. I wasn't around. I had kind of started to distance myself and just started to clean up after a while. And I found out about his death through a worker at Street Angels who had just said it very blatantly and just said, oh yeah, he's dead. He's on life support. So he's pretty much dead. It was actually a really hard way to hear it. I found it to be really insensitive. I know that they didn't mean anything by it, but I just had found this special kind of love for him just from the time that we had spent together, that it just felt so, not inhumane, but it just didn't feel like there was a face. Like, you didn't have a face. They were talking about a body. They weren't talking. And to me, I was like, no, this guy has a face. This guy has a name. Like, this guy has a heart. He has feelings. I don't know a lot about what happened. I know that he was struggling. I know he was in a lot of pain. And so I can see why he resort to painkillers, which fentanyl inevitably is.
What would you ask him if he was here today?
It's a bit of a loaded question, but if he came back today, I'd ask him what heaven was like. And I'd ask him if he viewed the world differently today, if we still were all clones of his mother. I'd ask him a lot of different questions like that.
What was the hardest thing about losing him?
He had stood up for me one night. I had put myself in a not-so-great position where I had invited to my house because she was sleeping outside. And she ended up having a boyfriend and some friends who kind of wanted to invite themselves. And I said, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. And they didn't like that. And he stood up for me and he let me get away. I was going to get robbed. I was going to get hurt eventually if I didn't leave that situation. And he stood up for me. He ended up hiding in a bush. I ended up seeing him hiding in a bush later on. But he had nothing to do with it. He did that all for me. And I never got a chance to say thank you.
How do you think he would want to be remembered? As Jesus? As the savior of the women of this town?
I think ultimately he loved that part of himself. However, I tried to help him remember who Jared was. And he would tell me, you know, he would say his name was Dennis. I won't say his last name, but he said, Dennis is devastated and disappointed with Jared. He would talk in third person like that a lot. Dennis is devastated with Jared. Dennis is sad. Dennis feels like he failed as a father. And he would say those things a lot. And it was the little bit of insight that I had on Jared. I heard a lot about Jesus, but I got a little bit of insight on Jared and his life. And I know that he really struggled with a lot of internal pain. I think that part of that is the mom side of me that wanted him to take care of that little boy within him who was named Jared, because the whole Jesus thing didn't come out until adulthood. So no matter what, I just didn't want him to forget about that little boy within him that was Jared. And that was genuinely sweet guy.
Can you talk about the biggest obstacles he overcame in his life? You might not know what I mean.
He was a drinker. And he went through a lot of, his alcoholism was off the chart. It was insane how much he was consuming per day. And the pain that comes with alcoholism is excruciating. I mean, the withdrawals, just the internal dialogue that he had going on inside, I believe was really, really hard for him. He had a lot of voices, mental illness that he had to push himself through. I know that every morning he woke up and he had to go and bathe himself because he would have terrible nightmares that would often result in sleeping bags getting wet. And I know from experience with having kids that when the kids were wetting the bed, there was something off. If something was going different in their world that wasn't fitting quite right. So as an adult having to struggle with that, I can imagine that he must have had some really deep, severe internal wounds that he was trying to tend to and wasn't able to have the tools to handle it properly.
Was there anything you and him disagreed about or fought over or had some conflict around?
I tried not to argue with him because he was very, very firm on his beliefs. And like I said, I felt like he just needed someone to just believe him, just believe what he said and not question him. And I think that helped.
Did you ever question him?
I think I questioned him to his benefit. I questioned him so that he could tell me more.
What about him makes you smile?
My favorite memory of him, he had a phone. I didn't have a phone at the time, and he had a phone. He wanted to show me this music that he listened to, and I wanted to show him. I have this band called Blue October that I absolutely love, and it's the lyrics are just incredible. So he showed me his song, and his song is more of a rap, and he's telling me about his other life that he lived in, and then we put on this other one, which is kind of like a love song, and I remember he was going like this. He was kind of dancing, and I'm listening to this song, like just bopping, and he came, and he started just kind of like petting me. Like this, and he's still dancing, petting me, and he just looking into my eyes like, this is a moment, you know? Like, we were just connecting as two people who loved music and who found a common understanding, like, together. I just came to his level, you know? I came to his level. I didn't want to be someone different to him. I wanted to be with him. I wanted to be on the same level, and when we were there, it was just like, it was like being on a sailboat in the middle of the ocean with the perfect waves, you know? Like, every wave was just smooth. And it just made me smile so big that day. I remember at the end of it, I was in tears just because it was so... To see him, you see him angry so often out in the world. So to see him smiling with this soft spirit of his was really, really... endearing. It was really nice to see.
What did he look like?
You're right. He looks like Jesus. I think there's more to just physical outward, what you see on the outside. I used to tell him, there's a few things that I used to say. He had a very strong spirit, and he would tell me that, you know, it's really hard being rejected everywhere that you go. Because he would go into a place and he gets kicked out immediately because he had some issues with anger. He was socially awkward, but he was also very, I'm not very good with the words, but very firm in what he believed to be true, and he wasn't willing to into other people's boundaries, other people's standards of what they expect. He just wasn't willing to hear it. He just said, I'm going to be me, and that's final. And I admired that within him. However, it didn't make it easy for him. And so I used to tell him, you know, instead of thinking that everybody cringes when they see, think of it this way. I used to say, when you walk into a building, people feel your energy, and it is so strong and so big, and they're not as strong as you. I said, you know, these people are much smaller, and so when you come in, it's not that they're repelled with disgust, but your strength, just like God. Right? They say you can't visually see God because he's just all powerful. And so I gave him this look where it was like a magnet. You know, when two magnets, when you turn magnets around trying to put them together, they repel out. And so I said, that's what your strength is like. So everybody sees you and they're like, wow, that's too big. That's too big. I can't take it. And he seemed to like that too. He also had one, well, actually, I think he had two lazy eyes. And so he used to say that he was on Pluto. So I said, well, if that's the case, then one eye must be on Pluto and one eye must be on Earth. And he was like, yes, I finally have an explanation.
What were his hopes and dreams for the future, do you know?
I think he really wanted people to hear him. I think he really wanted people to see the devastation on Earth. He knew a lot more than what we ever gave him credit for. It's funny how just it's all going with a kid who's playing make-believe. Well, you'd be surprised how much truth a child can bring out in a make-believe story that applies to our world today and how much we can learn from it. And, you know, I believed in him just to make him feel better. But then the more I heard him, the more I believed him. And this wasn't because I was in a psychosis. It's because I left my heart open to the possibility of it being real. And just simply by doing that, I was able to see a clear view of truth where some people would just say, no, I don't want to hear it. Just opening myself up to that was enough to hear
it believable to be Jesus when you know the story of Jesus and where the world is at today. He felt we were in the rapture and he was the savior.
Yeah.
He was the all knowing. Is there something about him that you think no one else knows? Or how are you different now than you were before you lost him?
I think that moment that I had with him where he did this and just sat with me, I feel like I got something from that nobody else really got to see very often.
I've never seen him be soft at all, so
yeah. You're
probably right there.
I think we created a bit of like a sister-brother type relationship that I felt was unique. Definitely, like what I was saying about just believing, keeping my heart open. You know, when you see somebody who deals with mental illness, it is so easy to just shut down the things that they say as being gibberish, as being total nonsense. However, the universe, God, whoever you, whatever it is that you believe in, I believe that there is a way that those things can be interpreted into something that resonates real for you. And I think it just goes to show that, you know, turning your back on anybody, you're cheating yourself out of truth that could be given through something that you may not have ever realized would be possible. But I call mental illness, and I call it mental freedom, because I believe that mental illness opens up another world of knowledge that we don't see in our sane lives. And although it may not make sense to you in the moment, when you open yourself up to the possibilities and you hear them out, it's incredible what you can take out of it.
Do you have any traditions to honor him?
I think camping again will be hard.
What has helped you the most in your grief? And what are the hardest times?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of with you on this one, Jerome. Like, I don't even know if I've dealt with it. I don't really know if I've even absorbed the idea that he's actually gone. And Brennan, too. I don't know if I've really soaked in the reality that they're gone. And, you know, I don't understand the afterlife. I don't understand those kinds of things. I hope for things. I have a lot of hopes of what the afterlife is, but I won't understand it until I live it, or until I die it. So I don't really know how I've dealt with the grief. I think I'm still in a bit of a stage where I push things down, but I hope to be past that one day soon.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the Unsilencing Stories podcast. To listen to more interviews in the series, please go to www.unsilencingstories.com. And if you'd like to share your thoughts on the episode, message us at unsilencingstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and please share the project with other people you know.